We've been doing quite a lot in recent months about spies and MI5, KGB, Asiophiles. And we're picking up that theme tonight by discussing all sorts of skeletons in family closets. My guest is Mary Kay Wilmers. And a few years ago, she wrote a truly remarkable book called The Eitingons, a 20th century story. One might suggest it's almost the 20th century story. And it is an astonishing account of relatives. Max Eitingon, a colleague of Sigmund Freud's, Motting, a fur trader in New York, but much more. And finally, Leonard Eitingon, a KGB assassin and spy. Mary Kay Wilmers is the longtime editor of the London Review of Books and also one of its founders back in 1979. And in 2009, after digging around, literally digging around in closets and archives and interviewing an endless number of relos, she published this, her first book. It's more than a family history. It's a spy novel. It's a political thriller, a murder mystery, and yes, a romantic tale told across continents. Somewhere in this book, there's a great line: maybe we all use our lives as a cover. Now, before we get on to Max, Motting, and Leonard, who they knew and what they did, I'm interested to find out a bit more why you wanted to uncover these fascinating lives. Was it a childhood curiosity?
No, I'd sort of always had a tendency to show off, saying that a rumour must have reached us, saying that we had, the family had, or someone with the same name had to do with the assassination of Trotsky. And although, if anything, as much as I knew, I rather admired Trotsky, I thought this was very interesting. I was rather proud of it. And as things opened up in the Soviet Union, I'd done Russian at Oxford. I hadn't known it beforehand, despite the fact that my mother obviously was Russian, and I thought I would do Russian. I thought I'd be a simultaneous interpreter and knew Russian and Spanish and French and some German. I thought that was my career. And so when Perestroika happened, I thought, I've been telling people I did Russian at Oxford, but actually I don't remember a word of it, so I'd better start relearning it. And in the course of relearning it, I opened up this story, and there'd been a piece in the New York Times saying that Max was a scumbag, basically. Stalin's artists and intellectuals are Stalin's killerati. It's written by a man called Stephen Schwartz. Sort of terrible alarm, you know, this nice man was in fact a killer. Well, he wasn't a killer, but that's how it began. And then the New York Review of Books took it up. A man called Theodore Draper, an American historian, also on the left, though more on the left to begin with than as time went on. And he took it up to prove that Max Eitingon had nothing to do with any of that, and they weren't the same Eitingons, and it wasn't the same family. Well, by then I was challenged, so I had to find out.
Now, the stars of the book are clearly Motty, Max, Leonard, and readers immediately get the picture that the book is not your typical family history when in chapter two you discover the Russian agent who drove the getaway car for Leon Trotsky's assassin in Mexico was one of your relatives.
Yeah, that's quite good, isn't it?
Good, it's phenomenal.
Well, you know, it's good to be connected with world history. It's not always the case. I rather admire them all for having taken part in the major movements of the time, really. I think, it sort of had a tendency as a family to be rather rootless and unconnected. And so I admire them for taking on the prevailing ideology, which as an ideology was absolutely fine. It just, in its workings, was rather less fine.
So is it fair to say that Leonard's biggest success was planning Trotsky's assassination?
Well, that's what Stalin was most grateful for, yes. He did other things. He He was quite helpful during the Second World War. He was helpful in the Spanish Civil War. He was helpful in China, plotting against the Japanese and busting open their safes and suborning their junior staff and so on. He was a smart guy. It's rather hard to know everything he did. There was a lot of, I knew his family. I talked to all his family who was still alive, and the most prominent and the most interesting of them was a woman called Zoya Zarubina, whose actual father was an agent in Washington, was head of the Soviet mission in Washington, but she was Leonid's stepdaughter, and she translated the atomic secrets. She was also an interpreter at Nuremberg, and she always quoted Leonid as saying, in my family, we don't talk about these things, and my secrets will go to the grave with me, was what he always said. So I don't know exactly what he did in any of these places, except he did in Spain hire the man who wielded the ice pick.
Tell me this. How many people can say that Joseph Stalin wrote an accolade for a relative CV? Stalin says, not a hair of his head shall be touched as long as I live.
That's right. Well, not many. But what's actually, in a way, more surprising is that Stalin didn't bump him off at that point, because normally, I mean, most of the people who did well in Spain went back to Russia to be bumped off. And he wasn't. He went to Paris, and then by a very circuitous route that I couldn't exactly work out, to New York and then to Mexico. And so he was following the actual Mercader, the man with the ice pick, a very handsome man, who put Mercader in touch with an American woman. And it was a terribly mean story. He made the woman who was a sympathizer, Fourth International sympathizer, who was quite plain, was seduced by this incredibly good-looking Soviet agent, and led to believe that, you know, everything was hers. He brought her flowers, he took her dancing, he did everything. And when they were in New York, Leonid, the two of them, Mercader and this woman, might be sitting at one table, and Leonid would be sitting at another table over here, you know, listening to their conversation. And now I know her grandson.
Was he a charismatic, attractive, handsome?
Well, that's the big puzzle, because he was quite big and thick-set and clearly imposing. But I asked people, what was the attraction? What was it? Why was everybody so taken with him? And nobody could say. They'd say, I said, what was his conversation like? He didn't speak. You know, so there was nothing. He smoked a lot of cigarettes.
Perhaps he was lucky.
Perhaps he was lucky. He had a lot of women,
Yeah.
And they really liked him.
Okay, the other key figures, Motti and Max. Now, Motti was someone you did actually know as a child.
Yeah. My mother's uncle. My mother was extremely fond of him. And he was very, very charming. And reading about him, that's another puzzle.
Now, let's remind the listener, we're talking about a New York fur dealer
who had the best concessions from the Soviet Union for mink and sable, and just the biggest, $10 million here, $10 million there. And then he lost his money one way or another, but he never really lost it. That's another thing that's such a puzzle.
What do you think? There was a Moscow gold trickling through?
I don't know.
The FBI, there's a Freudian slip. They were suspicious of him, weren't they?
They
used to go through his rubbish.
They went through his rubbish, but then they made this terrible mistake. They knew Leonid's surname. They heard Leonid's surname. They knew Motti's surname, and they didn't put the two together. That's a complete puzzle.
Yes, but these You know, state agencies are all full of wackos and fools, aren't they?
The absolute morons. There was an article in the Saturday Evening Post about Leonid Eitingon, and still they didn't connect it.
So to the end of his life, he's suspected of being a communist spy in the US, but the FBI, congressional committees, etc., couldn't pin a damn thing on him.
And I didn't, I mean, I tremendously regret that there's no member of my family alive who I could have amazed by telling them what he actually did do. And I have since found out little bits and pieces. He helped forge visas and passports for the Soviets. So I think it's clear he did work for them. But
at least flirted with them.
He flirted with them and a bit more, because he wouldn't have got those $10 million deals for nothing.
But having those fur concessions at a time when fur was very fashionable... He could have and should have been a highly successful businessman, full stop.
Well, he was quite successful. He sort of wheeler-dealered all the time. But my father, maybe he was quite naive, but my father was quite straight and maybe not imaginative enough. He didn't understand that Motti was just weaving a web around everyone. And you read through the deals. I'm not very clever at that sort of thing, but he would put money here. Well, one hears a lot about it now, doesn't one? You put money here and then you buy it and resell it and suddenly your shareholders are not the same as...
But he was also a Broadway angel, in effect, wasn't he? Because one of the reasons the FBI was interested in him was because he financed left-wing artists
and
playwrights, including a musical about a strike, A Cradle Will Rock.
Yeah, they made a movie about it. About that, it was the FBI stopped it, and so it had just one night where
that's a very short season.
It was a very short season, and I forget exactly how it worked, but they didn't actually put it on stage. People stood up in the audience and sang the parts. It was written by a man called Mark Blitzstein. And I remember him too, just. I was about 6 or 7 at the time. But Motti was always a glamorous figure with the biggest house and the, you know, I remember silly things like the navy blue bathtub. You know, who ever had a coloured bathtub?
It's very louche, isn't it?
It is very louche, but very Hollywood.
Okay, one of the reasons let's move on to Max. Now, Max is a fully-fledged psychoanalyst and a colleague of Sigmund's.
And a very good man, because he always appeared to be on the right. The other analysts who were quite on the left, especially in Weimar, sort of thought of him not as one of them. He was too Russian and too seemingly conservative. And Freud liked him because he was rich. Again, in that mysterious Eitingon way, because then he lost all the money and he was still rich. And so they didn't like him. He was slightly to one side. But he financed the Berlin Polyclinic, which gave psychoanalysis free. Can you believe that? It was like the British National Health Service. Nobody had to pay. And this was started by Max, and Freud thought psychoanalysis should be available to everyone. If you think how it is now, you know how they insist on, they're very particular about the 50-minute hour
and money on the counter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't how it was to begin with. And then Max, in 1933, Max emigrated to Palestine. He was quite sort of loyally Jewish or Zionist. He'd founded the Jerusalem Psychoanalytic Society. But now, I don't know if you know this, there's quite a lot of work being done by a couple of Israeli researchers, and they think it's the case that Max was working, but they're totally sure, I'm not totally sure, but I'm certainly willing to believe it, was working for the Soviets in Palestine.
So here's Max, who finances, who bankrolls Freud's Vienna Institute.
Through. And the publishing house, the psychoanalytic publishing house, the Verlag, as it's called. All of it. Freud loved his money. I mean, loved Max's money. He was especially close to Max. He called him by his first name.
Can we go back to Leonard's adventures in the Spanish Civil War? Here's what you say. He had his own kind of good time in Spain. Pretty doer at home, he loosened up here. Now he loosened up by killing many international brigade members who were fighting for the communist cause.
Yes, because the people they didn't like were the volunteers, the genuine believers, because Stalin was fighting a different sort of war in Spain and was basically getting rid of the true believers.
This is something that both Hemingway and Gellhorn wrote about,
yes,
for example.
Yeah. Well, Gellhorn didn't want to believe it and still didn't believe it at the end of her life. I don't know that Hemingway believed
it
either.
He was troubled.
Orwell certainly knew it. But Leonid was not on the heroic side. The Russians were undermining the Spaniards all along. And the main thing they did was to get the Spanish gold, which suited Stalin very well, and which he said to have nicked a fair amount for himself. Whether that's true or not, again, I don't know.
It has to be said that Leonid was one of Stalin's more successful agents, but he was arrested after the war, wasn't he?
That's because he was
Jewish. In the doctor's plot.
He was arrested because he was Jewish. He was treated rather like in Britain we have these special prisons for dignitaries. He was in one of those.
Where are these prisons in Britain?
I'm not sure where they are, but they're sort of open prisons where chartered accountants go. And that
Green
sort of
Park
thing.
And that
sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he went to quite a nice one, Leonard. And in fact, as a student in 1958, I was in the same town as he was in prison. The grammar isn't quite right there, but yeah. But I didn't know it, and obviously he didn't know it. But it's quite an intriguing thought.
He gets released, doesn't he, after the death of Stalin in 1953, but his troubles are not over.
Well, Beria loved him and loved his boss, and then the others didn't like Beria because they thought he was too smart and was pulling a fast one on them and too powerful. So they got rid of Beria, so they got rid of Beria's men. So he never had a job after that. And he thought he was still valuable and kept writing advice, as he had done in prison, kept writing letters to his former colleagues telling them what to do, which they didn't terribly want to hear from him, thought they knew what to do. So he died kind of ignored, but not suffering.
I know you prefer to write about women rather than men, or so you have said, but in the Artigans it's the blokes, as we say here, that take centre stage. But there's plenty of fascinating women who play a role in the saga.
Well, there's the inimitable Zoya, the incomparable Zoya Zarubina.
What a name, Zoya Zarubina.
Zoya Zarubina, she was fantastic. She died only a year or two ago. She was amazing. She was the most enterprising, cleverest woman I've come across. And so many good things. I mean, she came to London, she stayed with us. My children at the time were terrified of her. I mean, at the time they were children. And
I'm sorry, why terrified?
I don't know. They obviously knew something of her, and she spooked them. I mean, they were quite young. And, for instance, one of them played snooker a lot, so she wanted to play snooker. She just wanted to join in everything. But you would drive around which way should I go? And she would tell you, you've just driven round the block. And, you know, I was kind of amazed by that. Perhaps I shouldn't have been. But she always understood everything you said right away. And the fact that she translated the atomic squiggles, as she called them, that's pretty hotshot. She was an interpreter at Nuremberg. She was at Yalta interpreting with Mr. Roosevelt, as she called him, and Mr. Churchill.
What a woman, yeah.
So she was the big woman in the story. Leonard's other relatives, other women, they didn't do so well. I mean, they did okay. They were minor KGB functionaries. Some of them were nicer looking than others. He probably had a woman everywhere.
You are a seething hotbed. That's what you are.
That's right.
Mary Kay Wilmers, thank you very much. The book is called The Eitingons and it's published by Faber and Faber. A delight to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
On our next Dear Listener, we discuss the chances of Wendy Deng, the famous Chinese spy, according to Mr. Palmer, ever taking over the helm at News Limited, and Fred Burton would examine what went wrong in Benghazi on September 11 last year when the US ambassador was killed. Next up is the news on RN, and we will see you later. Thank you.